The Public Safety Finance Division will come to order. I can ask already, I'm hearing some noise with the sound system. If you could please turn off your phones, Representative Posh.
I'm going to tell you what I'm doing right now, but better.
Thank you.
How are you?
The obvious culprit for... members, today we are continuing with the Department of Public Safety's budget presentation. We went through a big chunk of it last week, and like we left off with the finishing up on the OJP presentation, and in your packet, at the request of the committee, we did provide you, and you can look this over, the grant monitoring protocol that the OJP uses to measure compliance with their grant, with the grants. You have a list of all of the grants that were made, and then you have a sort of a random selection of various programs that got OJP grants and what their reporting requirements were, and so you have those progress activity reports. I hope that that's helpful in helping you see how the office analyzes and measures those grant programs. There's no questions on those. On that, we're going to move on to the 911 armor presentation, followed by the BCA. I think the committee would like to look at some of, Commissioner has some questions about your contracts, and then hopefully we can get to a discussion what the impact of a 5 or 10% cut on your budget might be, just so we have that information. You should have a copy of the PowerPoint presentation. If you don't, Erica will provide you with that. If you could raise your hand, she has extra copies. So with that, Commissioner Campion, it's all yours.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members. Michael Campion, Commissioner of Public Safety. We'll just get right into it. You covered most of the schedule for this morning that I was going to mention, but Mr. Wiggins is the Director of the Emergency Communications Network. And go ahead, sir.
Oh, no, you go ahead and do that. Mr. Chairman and members, good morning. For the record, my name is Scott Wiggins. I'm the Director of the Division of Emergency Communication Networks at the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. I appreciate the opportunity to be here to tell you about the good work that we do in the 911 program and also in the ARMOR program. Mr. Chair, you should have this document that was handed out this morning. The bulk of my testimony this morning will be taken literally right off of this document. So. With that, Mr. Chairman, just first the mission of the Emergency Communication Networks Division, utilize emerging technologies to provide the most comprehensive emergency communication networks available. By developing professional partnerships and collaborating with our customers, we will deliver customer-focused network solutions that enhance public safety. For the purpose of your budget books, Mr. Chairman and members, the ECN budget information starts on page 111, and then the actual numbers are on page 114. The Minnesota statewide 911 program costs were funded from the state general fund until December 1986, and in 1987, the state began collecting a 911 service fee on wired telephone lines. And that was to pay expenses related to the 911 program. Beginning July 1994, the fee was extended to include wireless telephones, and today it also is collected on VoIP providers such as Vonage. Revenues from the 911 fee are deposited into a special revenue account, and in the 2008-2009 biennium, the amount that was deposited in that account was $106 million. And in the governor's request, or in the governor's budget for this year, that does increase to $121 million. And the increase is to pay the debt service on the bonds to continue the construction of the armor system. The special revenue account also provides funding for the East and West Medical Resource Communication Centers. Again, debt service on the revenue bond sold to construct armor, the armor backbone and maintenance costs, and Minnesota's interoperability program. The current fee assessed for wired line, wireless lines, and VoIP providers is $0.65 per month. In July of last year, we did have the discretion to raise that to $0.75. However, we did not do that because when we actually looked at this, when the bond sale would occur and when we need to make our first debt service payment on those bonds, it just made more sense to hold off. So we will be moving forward with a fee increase in July of this coming year. So it'll go from $0.65 to $0.75. Now, Mr. Chair and members, a little more specificity on the 911 program.
Mr. Wiggins, if you could just hold on 1 second, I have a question. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Wiggins, does that fee increase then account for the governor's proposed increase in the budget? Is that where that additional revenue is supposed to come from?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Again, Mr. Chair, a little more specificity on the 911 program. The statewide 911 program provides immediate access from all telephones to the 911 network. The program was originally operated by the Department of Administration and transferred over to the Department of Public Safety in 2003. And the 911 system handles over 2 million calls a year. I feel a little heat from the state fire marshal to have a trivia question. Maybe I should have had that as my trivia question. The 911 program, the fees that are collected are used to provide the statutory required problematic services, which are as follows. Technical assistance, administration of grant funds to public safety answering points. Network costs, which reimburse the telephone companies for the cost of connecting the 911 system to the selected routers that deliver the calls to the PSAPs. Costs of maintaining the databases that allow for PSAPs to receive name and location information with the emergency call. Enhanced 911 grants, which cover a portion of the cost of the equipment for the PSAPs. Grants to the Minnesota State Patrol to cover a portion of the cost for answering wireless telephone calls. Reimbursement to wireless service providers for implementing and operating 911 service costs. And then the administrative costs to operate the 911 program. Some of you may know that over the last 2 years, we've been working toward implementing a next-generation 911 solution. A next-generation 911 network is a high-speed, IP-based network that, upon full implementation, would be able to support voice, data, and video. It will be a fully interoperable IP network. It would eliminate the call transfer problems that we have today. It would significantly enhance the capabilities for persons with disabilities, would allow for remote network access, and it includes or enhances redundancy far beyond what we have today. I will note, Mr. Chair and members, that we are working with the Governor's Office on a budget change item that we believe will be forthcoming to fund Next Generation 911. The reason why it was not included in your packet this time around is that by the time the bids for this network got opened up and scored, it was just too late to include it in the governor's original budget. Now some history, Mr. Chairman and members, on the armor system. Planning for the system began in the metropolitan area in the 1980s. In 1993, a RFP was developed through the Metropolitan Council for construction of a region-wide shared radio system. In 2001, a plan was developed to extend the system into a statewide system. The original plan called for six phases. Phase one would be the metropolitan area. Phase two are the local enhancements to the metropolitan area. And then phases three, four, five, and six are in central and greater Minnesota. The armor system is actually owned and operated by the Minnesota Department of Transportation. The technology is a Motorola smartphone technology. The frequency range is in the 7-800 frequency range, and the equipment is P25 compliant. Current status on the armor system, Mr. Chair and members. in early 2009, all of the metropolitan area should be on the ARMR system. We're waiting for Scott County and Washington County to migrate. Washington County is very close. I just read an article in the newspaper a week or two ago that their folks are all going through training and they should be on the system in March. In Phase 3, which is 23 counties in central Minnesota and southeastern Minnesota, currently on the system are Olmsted and Stearns County, which also includes the cities of Rochester and St. Cloud. In southeast Minnesota, Freeborn, Goodhue, Wabasha, and Winona counties are in the process of migrating to the ARMR system. And in central Minnesota, Benton, Douglas, Grant, Canyon High, Otter Tail, Sherburne, and Wright counties are in the process of transitioning to the ARMR system. Many of the other Phase 3 counties are currently completing a radio study where they're determining the costs and pros and cons of transitioning to the ARMR system. In Phases 4, 5, and 6, when the legislature in 2007 gave us full funding to build that, we rolled that all together in one phase, which we call Phase 456. We have Itasca County that has recently transitioned to the ARMR system, and all the other counties are in the process of doing county-specific radio communication studies. The ARMR program anticipates that the basic backbone with 75% statewide coverage will be in place either late in 2009, but probably more realistically in 2010. And our goal is to have 95% of our locations complete by the end of 2012, which is before the FCC narrowbanding deadline. And then lastly, Mr. Chair, I will not take a lot of time to talk about our interoperability program or the governance structure for the statewide, for the ARMR program. But our governance structure, which is at the top has the statewide radio board, is nationally recognized. I've had the opportunity, at their expense, I would add, to travel for the National Governors Association and present on our governance structure here in the state of Minnesota. It is a robust governance structure, but it is truly bottom-up. And the success that we've had to this part in the state has come from a variety of different areas. First and foremost, obviously, legislative support, but then the structure that we have in place that allows for local people to be involved and voice their opinion and not feel as though they're losing local control on a shared system has been critically important to our success. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I will take any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Wiggins, for your presentation. Representative Hilston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me start by saying that I've carried a lot of the bills to fund this, and so I'm a strong supporter. Representative Murphy, however, has given me trouble with this for years and years, so I'm going to ask some of the questions that she might have otherwise asked had she been here. Again, as a supporter, I noticed that this program is one of the very few that's in the budget that's going to be expanding, and I know that's through raising fees. So when we're cutting everything else, why is it that we think that we should be increasing this? And we even took money from the Fire Marshal's Fund, which is totally generated from fees. So why do you think that this area shouldn't be contributing to the solution?
Mr. Wiggins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilstrom, the ARMR build-out, if you look at the timeline in which we're on, and my testimony, I indicated that we hope to have 95% of our base stations complete by the end of 2012. That's a pretty aggressive timeline, and the reason why we hope to have 95% complete by the end of 2012 is because of the FCC narrowbanding deadline. And I don't hate to get too far in the weeds here, but the radio systems that are operating across the state right now operate in what's called wideband mode. It's the frequency path is this wide, okay? The FCC is requiring it to be cut in half, from 25 kilohertz to 12.5 kilohertz. Most of the equipment that operates across the state by our emergency professionals today is not narrowband compliant and has to be replaced. So a delay in providing the ARMR system as an option that is available to them could lead to more counties, more local governments, just being the cheapest thing to get it done versus helping to move toward this shared network that really helps to solve our interoperability solution.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just the second half of that question, why do you think that this should be one of the only areas that doesn't contribute to the solution?
Mr. Wiggins.
Mr. Chair and members, The 911 fund is a special revenue fund. I represent Hillstrom. I don't quite know how to answer your question, but if we don't continue with this build out and have an opportunity for these folks to transition to the system, it does hurt our long term goals in terms of interoperability and having this option that's available to them. One of the other items that Mr. Chair represent Hillstrom is it's a good program that we have here, and we have had successes with the program. As you know, the armor system has been in place in the metropolitan area for some time. It was in place during the I-35W bridge collapse. The communications that occurred at that bridge collapse were noted by radio communication professionals across the country. It is really the first time that over 100 jurisdictions have been able to come together and effectively communicate. And can I sit here today and say that the armor system saved lives at the I-35W bridge collapse? No, I can't make that testimony. Did it help prevent some injuries? Did it help get people to the hospital faster? Yeah, I think I can safely say that. And to each of the emergency responders that I talked to that were a part of that response, to a person, they will tell you that ARMOR, the radio communication system, was one of the most important tools that they had that day. The other element, the other item I want to talk about is the Republican National Convention, which was a planned event. The I-35W bridge collapse was an unplanned event. Republican National Convention was a planned event. If you talk to the person who was in charge of communications in St. Paul for that event, when things really started to get haywire on that first Monday night, his ability to move whole tactical groups from one talk group to another talk group, which prevented communications from breaking down in the field, he had some interesting terminology to say how much he loved the system. I won't share that with you on the record today, but needless to say, Mr. Chairman and members, he was delighted by the performance of the armor system and the ability that it gave him to manage his forces in the field.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wiggins, my understanding of the 800 system is reliability is so much better there. But I come from the southern area of the state where we've got the valleys and going through the river valley. Because of that, with the reliability, though the range is decreased significantly, are we going to have to operate on kind of a dual system for a while this is up and running? And could you explain kind of how that works and when we may be fully covered?
Mr. Wiggins.
Mr. Chairman and members, Representative Kelly, the armor system is proposing to provide 95% mobile coverage across the state. Previously in my testimony, I'd mentioned that we're in the midst of doing county-specific studies. The coverage that the armor system is proposing is better than what most counties have right now. Specifically, I can give you Houston County as an example. Just recently read the report. Houston County is an area with very tough topography. Their current radio system, their current VHF system, probably provides them somewhere in the range of about 72% mobile coverage. Again, this system is proposed to provide 95% mobile coverage. There was quite a bit of belief within the radio communications industry that the VHF signal travels further than the 800 megahertz signal. And while in some cases that is true, in this new digital world in which we operate in today, some recent study out of the state of Oregon has shown that 700-800 megahertz digital system compared to a VHF digital system, in some cases the 700-800 outperforms. So it is truly not cut and dry on frequency bands, but topography, regardless of where you are in the country, topography is always an issue.
Representative Kelly.
Mr. Chair, so when we do the cutover, it will be one single system. We'll only be operating on that system.
Mr. Wiggins.
Mr. Chair and members, ARMOR is an option that is available for every public safety entity in the state. Transition to the ARMOR system does come at a cost, as does replacing their current communications infrastructure. We would love to see every single county in the state of Minnesota transition to the ARMOR system because it would really solve our interoperability challenges, but really it's a decision that has to be made by local governments. And that's really one of the reasons why we've partnered with them on these county-specific studies, because it is typically a 120, 130-page county-specific report that lays out what the cost is to upgrade their VHF analog system, what the cost is to migrate to a VHF digital system, and what the cost is to go to the ARMR system, and then the pros and cons of each of those three alternatives. We feel that that's the information that's necessary for the sheriff, the other emergency responders, and the county board members to make a good business decision on what radio communication system is best for them.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wiggins, my question relates to Next Generation 911, and I see that currently by 2010, we hope to have 75% of the state covered, and then 2012, 90, if I remember correctly, 90% of the state covered, 95% of the state covered with the basic system. The Next Generation 911 really sounds very good to me. But is that the 25% of folks in Minnesota that don't have that coverage right now, as they move to that basic coverage, are they going to be outdated when you move to the next generation 911 system? And my question then is, is it better to not waste that money, not waste it, but not invest it, and wait for the next generation system? Or you understand my question?
Mr. Wiggins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, for clarification, there's really two large-scale projects that we're talking about here. The ARMR system is a kind of a walkie-talkie-based radio communication system for emergency responders. And then the next-generation 911 network is an upgrade to the existing 911 infrastructure that we have. So the coverage that you're referring to is really on the ARMR side, not on the next-generation 911 side.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for being late here. I just wanted to get some clarification. So on the ARMR process here is for the backbone infrastructure, and you answered part of my question here on that local business deals that are done there. You're providing with them the information they need to either convert now because they may not be accessible to the process because of the backbone infrastructure, so you're giving them a timeline and when that's going to happen so they can make a smart business decision. I guess my question here is, just the monies that we have set aside for the 911 program or the ARMA program or for the backbone infrastructure, they do not have grants in them for local governments so that they can be included into the program?
Mr. Wiggins.
Well, Representative Severson, you must be reading my notes. One of the things I failed to mention in my testimony, Mr. Chairman, Representative Severson, is that while the metropolitan area and a portion of Phase 3 have been able to get state grants to help offset that transitional cost to the ARMR system, the bulk of counties in Phase 3, 4, 5, and 6 have not had that. We're also working with the governor's office on a budget change item that would allow grant funds to help offset that transitional cost. For a lot of counties, the transitional cost would be probably a microwave link into the ARMR system and then the handheld radios and the mobile radios. Again, because the 95% coverage is probably going to be better than what a lot of the greater Minnesota counties have right now. But there are some counties that desire to have a higher level of coverage, higher than the 95% mobile coverage. And for those counties, if they choose, they can build what's called a subsystem. That's pretty common. That's what's happened here in the metropolitan area. And then they fund the costs for that enhanced level of coverage.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just going off of Representative Severson's question, do you expect that there will be a proposal to actually increase from 65 to from the 75 cents even higher to get into these local grants given the proposed cut to all local units of government in the governor's budget?
Mr. Wiggins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, in the 2007 legislation that passed, it allows us to raise the 911 fee from 65 cents up to a max of 95 cents. And the way the bill was structured allowed us to do that 10 cents a year over the course of 3 years. The first year that we could have raised that fee was, again, our previous July of 2008. And again, we didn't do that because we didn't need the money to pay the debt service and the bonds. However, we do expect that over the course of the next 3 years, the fee increase will go up to 95 cents, and it will be to pay just for the backbone operating costs and the construction of the armor system. If we were to look at enhanced grant dollars for local governments, you know, I think we would look within the 911 fund, and then if you wanted to do something beyond that, you know, a large-scale grant program, probably the 911 fee would be where most people would look to generate that revenue.
Representative Allman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question I have is related, being from the farthest district up in the northwest corner. Am I to understand so far that my district has funded part of these grant programs, because the state has funded programs in the metro, and at this stage, my northwest corner counties, which are rather poor to start with, are being asked so far, unless there is some kind of grant program, to pay their own way?
Mr. Wiggins.
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Olin, the simple answer to your question is yes. And Mr. Chairman, if I might add to that,
Mr. Wiggin,
one of the questions that Representative Murphy always asked me, Representative Hilstrom, was, when's this going to make it to my neighborhood? And my response to that was, well, if you support me today, it will make it to your neighborhood faster than if you don't support me. But really, we have had a situation where the greater Minnesota counties have been paying the higher 911 fee, but the network isn't built in their area yet. So the network is being built in their area, and they will too be able to benefit from the technology of the armor system.
Yeah, I have a commissioner, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add a little bit of a response to Representative Wilstrom's question, which is an important one about cutbacks in this program. The cutbacks in this program, I think, will, Mr. Wiggins can support me or not, will hurt local units of government more than it'll hurt the Department of Public Safety. Those cuts will impact local units of government as they attempt to build or add on or connect to the build out of the system.
Okay, I just
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is it safe to say that when you say local units of government, the northwest corner, which is obviously the farthest away and won't get to them right away, is going to get hurt pretty badly with any cuts?
Mr. Chair, I'll ask Mr. Wiggins to speak.
Mr. Wiggins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Olin, we actually have, I believe, two towers under construction in Roseau County right now. And the Department of Transportation, who I mentioned owns and operates this system, has an existing tower in Roseau County. And in many cases, it's possible we're trying to leverage that existing infrastructure the Department of Transportation has across the state, because it costs about $750,000 to build a tower, and it usually takes about 12 to 20 months. So Roseau County is one of the lucky counties that will probably be on the system a little faster than some of the other rural Minnesota counties, just by virtue of having some towers in their county.
Mr. Wiggins, I just have a couple quick questions about some of the contracts within 911 Armor, the Emergency Communication Network. And I just don't know how common this is. And members, you should have a copy of this list in your packet from a few days ago. But there are a number of no-bid, single-source contracts. Can you explain to the committee how that happens and why?
Mr. Chairman, can you tell me, is there a specific person that you would like me to refer
well,
to?
Well, the handout that we received from the Department of Administration, there's one to Thomas Hannon for $130,000, a single source, no bid, and his responsibility was to assist counties and local agencies, I'm assuming, with the 911 armor. Is that MS-403-39?
Mr. Chairman, I can address the contract for Mr. Hannon. Mr. Hannon was a firefighter in the city of St. Cloud for 20-some years, and then retired actually as their IT director. He is the gentleman in the central part of the state that helped to put together the Central Minnesota Regional Radio Board, the governance structure in which I referred to earlier. He was the architect of this governance structure that we have today. And the reason why we sought a single source contract with him because there was no other person that had been through the two-year process of trying to balance all of the needs of the counties and the cities to come together in this governance structure to actually sign a legally recognized joint powers agreement and participate. In our estimation, he was the only person in the state that was able to, with the expertise, to be able to pull this together. And his success has been truly remarkable. We now have regional radio boards, seven of them across the state. We have most larger cities and every county participating in our regional radio boards. And as I noted in my previous testimony, our governance structure is really a national model right now.
And so how do you negotiate that contract then? It looks like it's over a two-year period. And is the contract expired now?
Mr. Hannon is under contract with us, and the negotiation, Mr. Chairman, it's typically like $60 an hour for his fee, and then his travel costs are consistent with the commissioner's plan.
So would he be considered an ongoing contractor with the Department of Public Safety?
Mr. Chairman, we do have them under contract, but the contracts do expire, and sometimes we can extend them, sometimes we can't. The Department Administration really tells us what we can and cannot do.
I don't want to go into this in too much detail, but then I can ask some of this to you in writing. But what about Ronald Whitehead, who used to be here quite frequently? There's an $80,000 single source, no bid contract. To him, I was always under the impression he was a state employee.
So, Mr. Chair, that's correct. Ron Whitehead is my predecessor, and we, due to the complexity of not only the armor system, but also the 911 system, we asked him to stick around to help in the transition. He's actually chairs a couple of committees that we have. He's been instrumental in writing the RFPs and the various grant proposals to receive federal grant dollars. So we have him do a variety of tasks that, quite honestly, Mr. Chairman, I don't have the expertise or didn't when I started this position to do those particular tasks.
So the state employee retires, collects his full pension, and then we hire him back for $80,000 to consult with the DCF.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. Again, the uniqueness of this particular individual is the institutional knowledge. He was with the Armor Program at its inception. He retired from the city of Bloomington as an acting police chief or assistant police chief with a significant understanding of radio communications and the 911 network. And this is an individual who's also an attorney. He's had an opportunity to go work for national consulting firms to the tune of about $165 an hour, but he is loyal to the Armor Project and really excited about seeing how it's coming together. So we feel pleased to be able to have his expertise.
And the final one I want to ask about is Steve Borchardt, who's also a familiar face around here. So he gets a $87,000 contract. And what's that about?
Mr. Chairman, one of the things I learned when I first started this job is that our communication with the local officials was lacking. And by virtue of not communicating with the local officials, they felt as though that the Armor Program wasn't advancing, that we weren't doing anything. So in the 2007 legislation, part of the funding package was to hire regional interoperability coordinators. And we have three regional interoperability coordinators. Mr. Borchardt is one of the three. He retired as the sheriff of Olmsted County. He submitted a proposal to be the Southern Regional Interoperability Coordinator. This was a competitive process, and he ultimately ended up coming out on top.
Representative Smith.
Chairman, thank you. Mr. Wiggins, has your system received in the past any federal grants, and are there any federal grants online or available for your system?
Mr. Wiggins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, and I want to say 2003, 2004, perhaps Director Idy might be able to help me out. Some of the federal Homeland Security funds that came through were used to help build out the metropolitan area. But since that time, the federal grants that have come through have gone out to the local officials. The federal grants that come through, 80% of those funds have to go locally. So they typically use them for interoperability equipment. It might be patching equipment. It might be multi-band radios. It might be updating base stations. It can be a variety of things. But yes, federal funds do still come through. But again, almost all of that money ends up going locally.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Wiggins, so 80% goes local and 20% stays with you, and how much is that?
Mr. Wiggins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, I don't have an exact dollar. I mean, I can get you an exact dollar amount of the federal funds that have come through and, you know, how those funds have been kept. I can tell you on the, with regard to the Homeland Security Emergency Management Funds, the 20% that is retained is to pay for the grant staff and so forth to actually to operate the programs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Haas. Thank you much, Mr. Chair. Testifiers. If I understand this properly, when you you talk about coverage, that potential coverage, you also have to have radios within the systems. Is that correct?
Mr. Wiggins.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Haas, the map that's in the book, yes, that's projected coverage. It is a computer model that has developed this. We think it's pretty accurate because we use two different computer models, and the models were based on drive testing that the Department of Transportation did. And then in order to use the ARMA system, yes, you would need a radio that can operate in the 700-800 megahertz range.
Okay, so when we're... Representative Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. Testifiers. So it's potential that when we're looking at an area that has coverage, if they are in a lower echelon, say a township, EMS, volunteer fire department, how are they getting their radios so that they can take advantage of being in the area that has the potential for coverage?
Mr. Wiggins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Haas, the dispatch centers, as you know, are predominantly operated by county officials. So you typically don't have a fire department, a volunteer fire department, or a rural EMS organization that's going to operate on the ARMR system unless their county decides to operate on the ARMR system. To help offset the costs, again, there have been some federal grant dollars that have come through, and then also FEMA has what are called fire grants, and there's been a number of counties across the state who've realized some great success by on a county level or multi-county level coming together and trying to buy radios to operate on the system. And then the last thing that we've seen in some counties across the state is the county, in the process of their transition to the system, will just buy enough radios to transition all of their emergency responders onto the system, so that because they recognize the value of everybody being on one shared standard platform.
Mr. Chair. Just one follow-up, and then I need a map clarification. I think that translates into this happens within this area, and then the county will start to be taking the responsibility so that townships, small cities, EMS, and fire volunteer fire departments have the radios enough to use the system. And I'm not too sure the money is happening in that direction, especially as now you start working your way out into the poorer areas. I think that's going to be magnified. That's just a comment. My next question is, I think on page 3 of this document, I think I looked at this in a global warming map and was the same map, so I don't understand it. No, I didn't look at it in a global warming map. I just don't know what green, and I think I know what green may stand for, but I have no idea what the blue and the white are. If you could give me a translation of that, I won't think it's for global warming.
Mr. Wiggin. Mr. Chairman, when this document was put together, we debated whether or not to put in a key that would explain what green, blue, and white means.
Well, that might have been helpful, Mr. Chair, but I mean, we'll take it now.
But ultimately, we left that on the editing room floor because we thought it would create more questions to put that in there. But let me provide you a response to your comment, but then also an answer to your question. Green indicates areas of the state where there is likely, and I say likely because it is a computer model, to be portable and mobile coverage. Blue indicates a 33 dBU strength. I'm not an engineer. 33 dBU strength, where you're likely to have mobile coverage. And white indicates an area of the state that is going to be less than 33 dBU. In some areas that are white in the state, we will have coverage. In some areas of the state that are green, we will not have coverage. It is a computer model. But based on the multitude of models that have been run, not only by the Department of Transportation, but also by the consulting firm that's doing the vast majority of these studies across the state, the coverage that we're going to have is really going to be quite terrific. Now, just a response to the question about the poor emergency response agencies and replacing their equipment. Again, I have to back up to the FCC narrowbanding deadline. The vast majority of the equipment that is used out there today has to be replaced. The option to do nothing is not an option for most people. So again, we're trying to build the armor network out to make it an option that is available to them. But that cost of replacing their radios, whether it's a VHF analog or digital or an armor radio, that's a cost that those local entities are going to have over the course of the next couple of years.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that the limit on the raising 10 cents per year was per fiscal year, or was that per calendar year?
Mr. Wiggins.
Mr. Chair, remember, it was fiscal year. It's that July 1st of each year.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
So, Mr. Wiggins, it said they could only do it on July 1st of every year, or is there any reason you couldn't raise that 10 cents yet this year, this fiscal year, before July 1st of next year?
Mr. Wiggins.
We could do it before July 1st of this year, but again, we decided not to do that because we don't need the revenue yet to pay for the debt service on those bonds.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there anything in the charge of that money that says that the legislature couldn't permit that 10 cents to be used to fund these local units of government help with the transition to the armor?
Mr. Wiggins.
Mr. Chairman, you could do that, but then we wouldn't have the revenue to pay for the debt service on the bond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much would the 10 cents that you chose not to raise for this year raise in a year for maybe one-time grant to help folks transition onto the system?
You know, I don't have the figure in terms of what the... I would have to get back to you on that. I can't do the math in my head that fast. I would note, Mr. Chair, that I did previously mention that of... funds in the 911 account, we are working with the governor's office on a grant program to help offset or help the transitional costs of transitioning the armor system. No matter where I travel in the state, in fact, we've had county boards pass resolutions that have basically said, we believe that armor is the best option available to us, and they actually instruct the sheriff to come back with a plan on how he or she will get grant dollars to help offset the cost of transitioning. So we're very cognizant of the cost of transitioning the armor system, and that's why we're so active in trying to get any federal grant dollars that we can get and try to help them mitigate. Now, we're not replacing their equipment. We're really just trying to fill that gap between what it would cost to replace their existing system and the difference between migrating to the ARMR system.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I was on this committee when we started this whole issue with ARMR back in 2004, and I guess is there some way we could get some information about when this was started, what it was projected to cost, what it was projected to look like in cost, and kind of where we are today and how much we've spent and how much it's going to cost to finish this thing? Could we get that kind of information so we can kind of understand where we've been and where we're going?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastland, the Statewide Radio Board did a study, I believe it was in 2005, and it was if everybody went out and replaced their radio system, what that would cost. And the cost was between $800 million and about $1.2 billion. Doing it the way that we're doing this here and having the ARMR system that is available for everybody, I don't know what the final cost will be when it's all said and done, because I don't know how much money the local officials are going to spend, but this system will be about a $500 million system. Now, what the state has proposed to spend on the system is set. In the 2007 legislation, it required us to do a study to determine if we could actually complete phases 4, 5, and 6 for the $186 million bond dollars that were allocated in the 2007 bill. We completed that study. We had L. Robert Kimball and Associates do that for us. They came in and sat down with the Department of Transportation and literally went through every proposed site, every tower, every piece of cable, every nut, every bolt, every repeater, every antenna, and every concrete pad, every shelter, every channel, everything that makes up a tower site, added some inflationary costs for steel, land, etc., and they completed that study and determined that to complete 4, 5, and 6, the cost would be about $175 million. Well within our range of $186 million, so we feel that we have about an 8% contingency for increased costs. So in terms of how much it's going to cost us, I think that's pretty well set. We know what our budget is, and we do everything we can to try to save money. And I'll just give you one example. It takes the Department of Transportation 12 to 20 months to acquire a piece of land. Per state law, transportation has to pay not for what the land is used for today, but rather what they intend to put on that piece of land. So as a result, they pay a higher cost for that land by virtue of putting a radio communications tower on it if it's just a piece of farmland someplace. So we are actually trying to partner with counties in many places if possible. Counties can typically acquire land faster and a whole lot cheaper than what the state can acquire land. And really the check and balances here, we propose to the county, if you can acquire the land for us for free, we'll build a tower, and then the space capacity that we have for antennas and so forth, you can use our tower. It's a wonderful check and balance, and it's a wonderful collaboration between state government and local government. We did this in Big Stone County, and they were able to acquire land a heck of a lot cheaper, and they were able to get it within 3 months. So that is just one of the things that we're trying to do to save costs on the backside of the program.
Mr. Wiggins, before we move on. Oh, Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wiggins, in regard to the federal grants, do you have any idea on a local level how substantial they could be from a percentage of the total cost that we'd be getting? And secondly, I know it's early, but from the stimulus bill, was there any set aside public safety specifically for this type of build-out?
Mr. Wiggins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelly, with regard to your first question about the percent, for those counties that have had state grant dollars available to them, the offset has been somewhere in the range of about 27%. But again, there's a bulk of counties in greater Minnesota that don't have those state grant dollars. And leveraging the federal grant dollars, the percent, I really don't know. It is really dependent on each individual county. And what I mean by that is,
know, if the population is a little bit higher in one county and they want to add a channel of capacity, for example, that's going to be a higher cost than if a county just comes on and operates what the state is willing to provide to them. So in terms of a percent, it really is going to be different on a county-by-county basis. But I can tell you that, you know, my goal here is interoperability. You know, interoperability is the challenge that we face, and I'd like to see every single county on the ARMR system. But every county is moving at their own rate, and every county has to come to that decision on their own. A mandate is not going to be effective. And then, I'm sorry, I forgot your second half of your question.
Kelly, the stimulus package.
Mr. Chair, now I remember why I forgot the second half of your question. The stimulus package has terminology about broadband wireless. It doesn't really have specific terminology about these types of radio system. I did email some people at the federal level yesterday with some language that I read out of an article asking what does this really mean to us. I don't believe that there's anything in the federal stimulus with regard to this type of system, but I can't conclusively say that until I hear back from the Department of Homeland Security Office of Emergency Communication. And quite honestly, I think there's a fair amount of people at the federal level that don't quite know what the legislative intent is with regard to some of the funding packages in the bill.
Mr. Wiggins, just a couple quick questions here about the budget book on page 114. If you could just clarify some of those contracts that I read off earlier, those were two of several of them. Where would I find that on the budget tape? Would that come under other operating expenses?
Mr. Chair, I would like to defer that to Frank Ahrens, our budget person. Mr. Cherry informs me that that is correct.
And then Mr. Ahrens, on the line, also in that same category, the transfers. What are those transfers from the last biennium to the current biennium?
Mr. Chairman, let me take a crack at the transfers. The transfers are for debt service on the bond, so the funds are transferred over to the Department of Finance. Transfers are for the operation and maintenance costs of the ARMR system, so that's a transfer to the Department of Transportation. I had mentioned in my testimony that some of the 911 funds go to fund the East and West EMSRB centers. That is a transfer to the EMSRB, and that is the bulk of it. Am I missing anything there, Frank? That's everything.
Very good. Are there any other questions on this budget? Mr. Wiggins, thank you for your presentation. Commissioner, looks like we're moving to the BCA now.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Olson, Deputy Commissioner. I'm going to go over just the first couple of slides, and then I'm going to turn it over to Mr. O'Malley to provide some further information. Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, their mission is to protect Minnesotans and all who visit the state by providing services to prevent and solve crime in partnership with law enforcement, public safety, and other criminal justice agencies. The annual direct appropriations of $43.86 million per year that go to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Of those funds, $41.9 million is from the general fund and $1.94 million is from the trunk highway fund. We have a budget change item in the DWI area. BCA operates a statewide DWI testing program with intoxicators at 200 law enforcement locations around the state. Prior to the 0203 biennium, the program was funded by trunk highway money. The change item is to return funding for this initiative to the trunk highway fund. So it is really a transfer from paying for this out of one fund and transferring it to another. This is a logical shift since the primary use of the account is DWI enforcement and the State Patrol is funded through the Trunk Highway Fund. Next budget change item is the DWI reinstatement fee. This change item seeks to amend statute in 2006 1.1.29 subdivision 2 to annually appropriate to BCA the 8% of the DWI reinstatement fee that is credited under current law to the BCA account of the Special Revenue Fund. This would modify the appropriation from direct to statutory to ensure that the funds that are indeed collected can be used. Right now there is a cap on the use of those funds, so the money is growing in the account. And in other areas, like in the State Patrol, they're able to collect their portion of the DWI reinstatement fee and use all that is collected. In the BCA, they have a capped appropriation, so this change item would allow them to use all of the funds that are collected in that account.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do you anticipate that that would offset any of your funding, or do you believe that that would just be used to use it for whatever you want?
Ms. Ellison.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tim O'Malley. I'm the superintendent of the BCA.
Superintendent O'Malley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, the analysis of that change, looking back over the last several years, would probably result in an increase of about $100,000 to $110,000 per year, and our plan would be to use that to fund scientists at the BCA.
Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair, Superintendent O'Malley, so then would that then show up as a different line item then, and then they would end up in your FTEs as well, just as all the other separate items show up in the budget book?
Superintendent O'Malley.
Mr. Chair, members, yes. Yeah.
Thank you.
Ms. Ellison, did you want
to... With that, I will turn it over to Superintendent O'Malley to talk about the different areas of the BCA and their activities and accomplishments.
Superintendent, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to tell you about the BCA, some of our accomplishments, and progress we've made on a number of the initiatives that have been brought forward to us from the legislature or others in the last few years. As Deputy Commissioner Ellison mentioned in the mission statement, and it meshes with DPS's mission statement, we are certainly mission-driven in public safety, and in particular, I'd emphasize the fact that we are a service agency. We exist really solely to assist others, to provide services to others in the criminal justice system, and we do that in partnership with them. Our goal is never to duplicate services that others provide, certainly at the local level, but rather to add essential value to what they do in terms of public safety. Deputy Commissioner Ellison and Commissioner Campion had asked me to, in this presentation as I go through, to also address some of the questions that the committee had put to DPS since the last hearing, and that would deal with the efficiencies that are in place, some of the major initiatives and pilot projects that we have, and talk about those and how we measure the progress in those areas. The BCA has three primary divisions: investigative, laboratory, and the information system division. We also have a number of activities that cross division lines, training as an example. I think in the last few years, certainly, and beyond that, we have made wise use of technology in particular, and we also have reached unprecedented levels of partnership both in government, with nonprofits, and in the private sector, and I'll try to highlight those as we go through the three divisions. The first division is the investigative division. At the core of the investigative division would be narcotics enforcement, sexual assault investigations, other violent crime investigations. When we were here last week, we had a team of BCA employees up in Kanawha County working on the double homicide that took place the night before. Today, as I sit here, we have a team of BCA employees up in Manoman County working on the shooting of Deputy Dewey up there. Those are two, I think, clear examples of the type of service that we try to provide that augments or supplements what local law enforcement can do. In both of those counties, it would not make sense, it doesn't seem, talking to the sheriffs there, for them to invest in the kind of equipment and level of expertise that's needed to investigate crimes like that are relatively infrequent in a particular location, but happen with a level of frequency around the state that somebody has to be prepared to provide that assistance. And you can go back years. You look back to the Callie Jo Larson case and the type of service that the laboratory provided there in seizing evidence in that house in Waseca. That was the first murder ever in the history of Waseca in over 100 years. It took the crime scene team several days to go through that house, and it was all done. Thousands of pieces of evidence were taken in two pubic hairs at the end of the day. A month later, when the suspect was identified, was the only physical evidence that linked that suspect to the scene. The Jessica Swanson case down in Goodview County, that's another example of we had that house for several days after she was abducted, and we ended up, not just the crime scene, but we ended up using some fairly high-level sophisticated electronic surveillance equipment that resulted in some very valuable evidence. And again, to purchase this equipment or have the expertise, the training to do that, it wouldn't make sense for Sheriff Dean Alvarez to invest in that, but we do that. Those are the core services we provide. I would offer a few examples of some areas dealing now with the efficiencies and the some major initiatives, many of which came from the legislation last few years. First one I would mention is the Internet Crimes Against Children effort that we have. Excuse me. 2 years ago, the legislature funded a Crimes Against Children unit at the BCA. That unit is up and fully operational. Shortly after that was funded, the St. Paul Police Department moved their Crimes Against Children unit into the BCA. We have partnered with them. We together work hundreds of child pornography and child abuse cases involving the Internet every year. We get those really in two ways. Some are self-initiated here in Minnesota when we get leads from different places. And secondly, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children provides leads to all 50 states, and those come into the BCA for anywhere in the state of Minnesota. We have received hundreds of those a year, and then we follow up on those in partnership with the St. Paul Police Department. One area that has been extremely, I think, productive and efficient, and it came as a direct result of the appropriation from the legislature 2 years ago. One of those positions, you may recall, was an IT position within this unit, and there was sufficient funding to purchase some software and some other equipment. And what that position has done is the forensic analysis of computers. A little over a year ago, around the country, when you had these types of cases, you would have a computer from the suspect, you would have an analyst who would work on that, and you would have some equipment, some machinery that could analyze that computer. It would be a one-to-one-to-one analysis, and that would be a kind of a painstaking process. Through getting some information from other states, we have gotten some software and hardware in the BCA, and this IT person has put together a system where now when we get a computer in with suspected child pornography or other evidence on it, that hard drive is copied, is put on a server, a secure server. Multiple hard drives can be on the server at one time. So instead of a one-to-one-to-one, now we have these hard drives copied on a server. And then we have remote locations around the BCA where there's some privacy because some of the stuff is very offensive. The local investigators can come to the BCA, sit down, and go through that evidence then. We have held training classes, two in the fall, I think it was in October, November, and one just in January, 30 officers each. So now 90 police officers around the state have developed the expertise to use this software that's been developed so they can sit there and rather than have a forensic analyst go through it one-to-one, they can sit there and go through that evidence, and then they bookmark images or emails or whatever it is that's evidence for their case. They bookmark it. They then send it back electronically to the forensic area, the BCA. They then put together a package for investigative and prosecutorial purposes. It's a very efficient way to get to this. It's a way to use those with expertise in this case to examine that. I'll give you one quick example. Some child molesters, we've had investigations where when you talk to them, they'll be remorseful to an extent, and they'll offer some confession and offer some information. We had one recently who said, yes, I did some of these things, and we wanted to know where the victim was. Our number one priority in all these cases, doesn't need to be stated, but it's to rescue children from these situations. Secondarily, but obviously very importantly, is to prosecute the case. So we're trying to identify the victim. The person gets in with the police officer, drives around and says, I think that's the house where the molestation took place. Turned out as they're driving, he decided I'm not going to fess up anymore, and he lied about where the house was. So the investigator went back to the BCA and started Googling and looking at the computer and tried to figure out, and was able to determine that the suspect had Googled an address that was a block away. So he was then able to go and find the child, and that's the kind of thing that a forensic analysis, a forensic examiner probably wouldn't have known enough about the case. So by using local law enforcement, partnering with them, investing them in the case, they can do this. The next step in this is to establish a secure line between the BCA and local law enforcement so that they don't even have to travel to the BC anymore. They can sit at their department, and whether it's in Coochin County or Nobles County, and not spend the time driving here and go through it, bookmark, send it back to us, and we can get it back to them quickly. In this arena, we have, a year ago, there were 17 affiliates, we refer to them as. Those are local law enforcement agencies that have received the training, separate from the 90 officers I'm talking about, but who have received the training in their department to handle these types of investigations. Today, there are 51 affiliates. These are local law enforcement agencies that now have the equipment from the BCA and have had the training on how to do these types of investigations so that we can identify victims, we can gather the evidence, and have it so it's admissible in court. Also in that legislation, there was a training position. That person presented about 90 presentations last year to different community groups and law enforcement and prosecutors and groups around the Minnesota to over 10,000 people. Lastly, about this initiative, this team of investigators between the St. Paul Police Department, the affiliates, and the BCA were the recipient of the 2008 Crime Prevention Team of the Year by the Minnesota Crime Prevention Association because of the efforts that I just described. In investigations, the second one I'd highlight is the Missing Persons and Unidentified Dead Project. A couple of years ago, the legislature provided one-time funding for us to establish a database to examine these two groups, if you will. One, missing persons entered into NCIC, the national database. When they're in there for over 30 days, the BCA now gets a ticker. We get notified that there's somebody in there for over 30 days. There are generally between 500 and 550 people in that database at any time as people go missing and come back. Sometimes they run away, sometimes there's something else going on. Separate from that, there's unidentified dead bodies around the state of Minnesota. At the time this initiative started about 2 years ago, there were 19 unidentified dead bodies entered into this NCIC database. After 9/11, President Bush decided they used DNA to try and identify minuscule amounts of body parts to figure out who died in that tragedy. We're trying to apply that exact same science here to match up missing people in one state or anywhere with dead bodies maybe somewhere else. So the process is we have now gone, whenever anybody's missing for 30 days, we work with local law enforcement to obtain fingerprints, photos, DNA, and dental records and get that into NCIC. At the same time, we've now identified 200 dead bodies at medical examiner's offices around the state of Minnesota, gathering the same four pieces of information, putting that into a database, letting the computer try to do the match. In turn, that is now plugged into a national database. There have been two cases so far here in Minnesota where through DNA matches, we now have identified somebody who was dead in one of them in another state in Florida with a missing person from Minnesota from about 20 years ago. You can see that as this gets populated, there's just going to be more and more of that. This will help solve crimes and will also just help solve mysteries for families as to what happened to their loved ones. For all we know, Jacob Wetterling maybe was abducted and remained alive for a while and is alive today, or maybe he died in a car accident in Arkansas 10 years ago and his body lies there unidentified. This would be a way for us to match that up through forensics. The third area in investigations I would mention is the predatory offender registration area. A lot of progress has been made in the last couple of years. You recall this started in 1991 with a few hundred registrants. Today there are over 20,000 in the database. 2 years ago, the legislature funded three additional predatory offender investigators at the BCA. That combined with a couple of other initiatives, one, the non-compliant website that went up in October of 2006, and then last year there was legislation that now requires jails are mandated to check the predatory offender registration records of anyone that's booked into the jail. Those three initiatives have contributed to taking the non-compliant rate from about 11.5% a couple of years ago down to 6.3% today. The non-compliant website, for example, has had over 140,000 tips in 2 years, hits, resulting in 263 specific tips as to where non-compliant offenders might be that we followed up on. The laboratory or the jail mandated checks that went into effect in October of 2008 has resulted in 2,600 bookings that have been checked. People who have been checked and turned out to be offenders that have been booked into Minnesota jail. That has resulted in 341 non-compliant sex offenders who have been located in the last 8 or 9 months and brought back into compliance or else charged with additional crime. The last thing in investigations is the cold case unit. I just mentioned very quickly there, it is still very active and successful. There have been 7 indictments in the last 2 years for cases, some of the toughest cases in Minnesota to solve these cold cases. With your permission, Mr. Chair, I'll move on to the laboratory then.
Superintendent, I have a question before we move on. If we were to look at all those different categories, the special agents, the cold case unit, emergency response team, the law enforcement training, I guess those primarily, but maybe all of the ones that you listed. Let's start with that. How many of those individuals have state cars?
Each agent in the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension has a state car assigned to that person.
Okay, let's first start with special agents. How many special agents are there?
There are, I think we have 67 special agents today.
67 special agents, and they all have state cars assigned to them?
Yes, they do.
And can you tell the committee why?
Certainly, all of our special agents are on call at all, not on call under the contract, but respond to crime scenes or respond to different investigative efforts at any time that they may be called out. So fairly often, in fact, most often, I would think investigators, when they leave home, don't go to the BCO or don't go to their field office. They most often probably go out and conduct investigations on the street.
So, Superintendent, so they're on call 24/7, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, no, Mr. Chair, I wouldn't say they're on call 24/7 because it's not under the contract yet, but they are available, they are in touch. For example, when this happened yesterday up in Monoma County, a page went out, and I would think we probably had 20 to 25 agents go up there between crime scene and SWAT and investigative agents. And it's important that they can respond as promptly as possible from wherever they happen to be in the state or home or at court or wherever they might be at that moment.
But wouldn't it be accurate to say, Superintendent, that oftentimes it's post? I mean, you're not a first responder in a lot of cases. I mean, you come after the event has been investigated by local law enforcement. So why couldn't that special agent check out a car and go to that crime scene, especially, you know, if it's in, you know, so depending on the distance, and just trying to get at why each individual agent has to have a car.
Well, Mr. Chair, and members, in the case yesterday, for example, it was critical that we got there as soon as possible. That standoff went on for 8 or 10 hours. It was very cold. They rotated the perimeter. They rotated the arrest team, I'm sure, every half an hour or so.
But how often does that happen? I mean, how typical is that? I mean, I this has sort of boggled my mind why every special agent has a state car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, you're right. That's an unusual situation. And you're also correct that we are always an assisting agency. We have no original jurisdiction anywhere. Somebody is going to start some investigation with few exceptions. There might be some public corruption or some narcotics cases where we initiate. But otherwise, we're always an assisting agency. The agents work... again, it's seldom that they work from the office so much. They have equipment in their cars. They similar to a troop almost, they work out of their cars more often than not. They have, whether it's their evidence kits, whether it's their SWAT gear, whether it's when we have two agents still who are certified to respond to meth labs, they have their CBAs and other things in the trunk of their car. Or they have specialized equipment, the surveillance equipment, some of those kinds of things. So to take the time to drive back to the BCA from wherever they're at and check out a car and have to load that equipment in there, I don't think would be as efficient in terms of the time. I think it would probably be more costly than it does to have them in a vehicle that they have equipped and ready to use no matter what the situation might be.
Does that cost the state of Minnesota for each agent to have a state car?
I'd have to get back on the exact amount. I mean,
can you get that number for us?
Absolutely.
And also the cost of gas. And are you familiar with the state policy on state cars?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Okay.
And are you confident that the special agents with the BCA apply or abide by that state policy?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I've looked at that policy in the past year. We've actually gone through all of the cars that are assigned and make sure that we're in compliance with the state policy.
How do you know that? Would it surprise you that some special agents don't have personal cars?
I'm not aware of any special agent that does not have a personal car, Mr. Chair. So it would surprise me, yes.
Yeah, I want to follow up on this at a later point, but I want to draw your attention, and I think, can you tell me how many other investigative units also have state cars in addition to the special agents?
Mr. Chair, do you have other investigative units?
Well, I'm just the cold case units, the law enforcement train. Do these people have state cars too, or do they check them out from the other investigative units?
Mr. Chair, the investigative, the agents have state cars. The analysts and others would not. That's what you mean by the units?
Okay. Okay. We have a couple of questions. Everything all in.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm going to give you both a question. I'm going to give you a question, but I'll also have a comment after your question. Now, a lot of these special agents in the BCA are in greater Minnesota. Is this not true? Mr. Chair, members, yes. And it would almost be nearly impossible probably for them to operate without a car of their own.
Superintendent O'Malley.
I would think so, yes. Now I'm going to give you the example that happened in northern Minnesota. Now this is a comment. In Payne County, we had a murder of a young child, almost a baby, where we called in the BCA at the very beginning of the case. They got there within 2 hours, and they're not located in Keeper Falls, contrary to what anybody might think, that the Bemidji agent came over and put together an excellent case, and that person is presently locked up for life. In a county not too distant away, they did not call in the BCA right away, and they had the same training as the police over Pennington County officers would have had, and I don't know that they ever got a conviction for anything in that case. It was almost borderline similar facts. So quite frankly, at least in greater Minnesota, you need those agents to respond quick. They do a great job, and I think in greater Minnesota, they do need their cars. Now, whether that's true statewide, I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just going to reiterate the same fact that, just so you know the profile of a BCA agent, I worked with them for half of my career. These are highly trained, over the scale of a detective. You don't just get on the BCA special agent list. I mean, the testing procedure, usually they come from other law enforcement. You have to have investigative experience to be there. And when you see these murders and major crime scenes, you always see this great big BCA van there. And these other people show up, and it really is imperative that they have cars. Because usually when a BCA agent is called, it's because some chief of police or sheriff is saying, help. Because the murder, the different things that go on, the police shootings, those are the specialists that come and really work with our law enforcement people. So we'd want them there just as fast as they possibly could get there, especially the 64 or 67 that you're talking about. I can't speak for the others because I haven't worked with them, but those special agents are highly trained in their area of expertise, whether it be homicide or whatever type of investigation they do. So for those people, I would think it would be just absolutely imperative to have a car.
Yeah, and I would certainly understand in rural Minnesota why you would have agents located in those areas having their state cars. And the question would be more of those agents in the metropolitan area who could check out a car and get there in a timely manner. That's the question that I have, and the concern that I have that some of these agents perhaps are using their cars for personal use is a concern I think we should be looking at statewide with vehicles. I was at a grocery store just the other day and saw a state car someone had his personal dog in the back seat. State car, I didn't take down the license plate, maybe I should have, but these are the kinds of things that I don't think that I think that we need to get a handle on. Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, I was driving down the cities about 2 weeks ago and came past a van that had a individual in it, just a non-conspicuous van, had state-exempt tax placed on it, and I asked the Department of Vehicle Services to run the plates on it for me. It turns out it goes to a group home. And I'm kind of thinking, well, how many group homes do we have? And I didn't know that they were entitled to a vehicle. So I think, Mr. Chair, you've got a good point here. I think it's something that we need to take a look at
not just through Bureau of Corrections, but across the government-wide, how many vehicles do we actually purchase and have at the disposal of some of these programs that we are funding currently? Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So maybe this is a follow-up, Superintendent, or maybe this to Commissioner Campion. Maybe you could provide the committee just with a list of all of the state cars that DPS has, and who has them. And if there is a way to look at a budget item on that, that would be helpful.
Happy to, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Olin.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. This is a follow-up, too, and I think the other thing that I've heard complaints about, not so much about the DCA, but about DNR, which is a whole different area, is how often you turn those cars over. Do you turn them over? Are they brand-new cars every year, or how long do you use the car?
Mr. Chairman, members, I can tell you that we run our cars to between 80 and 100,000 hours, or 100,000 miles, depending on its use, and we've actually increased that a little bit in the last few years. It comes into a number of different issues on safety and resale value and all that, but a fairly detailed analysis goes into that. I can assure you we have a committee that looks at that and also matches up the cars with the needs. For example, there's some in greater Minnesota, more often they have four-wheel drives because they'll go to locations where you have to get to the body by the river, whatever it might be. And in the metro area, we do less of that. We take gas mileage into account in purchasing vehicles and so on. And, Mr. Chair, I recall a couple of years ago, you and I had a conversation about this issue, and it was brought to my attention. And I assure you that we have been scrupulous in looking at our vehicles. If there are some misuse, I will ferret that out, and we'll deal with that. I'm not aware of any, and we have in the last year looked very closely at that state statute, and I applied that and forced our division directors to apply that to every single vehicle assigned at the BCA and make sure we're in compliance. But we will look into that and look into the cost, and I'll personally get back to you.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you very much. Now I'm curious to the testifier. Is there any lease cars in the fleet? Do you do any leasing of cars or just purchasing of cars?
Superintendent O'Malley.
Mr. Chairman, we have no lease cars at the BCA.
Mr. Chair, has that option ever been looked at as a possibility of saving money and certainly in the capital investment?
Superintendent O'Malley.
Mr. Chair and members, yes, it has, and I can't tell you the details of that analysis, but I know that was done, and it was determined that, especially in light of some of the resale value, we were better off purchasing them, using them, maintaining them well, and then and the money that comes from the resale goes right back into the same account to fund vehicles.
Mr. Chair, one follow-up question, please. In the maintenance of the state-owned cars, is the state doing the maintenance, or is that contracted out?
Superintendent O'Malley.
Mr. Chair, members, the state, we don't have a state mechanic that I'm aware of. It's done by the private sector, but depending on the cost of the repair, there's a requirement for bids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent, we've only got about 5 minutes. Do you want to start with the BCA services forensics slide, or should we wait till we have another day carved out to finish DOC, which we did not finish either? I don't want you to rush through because this is important and we have time. So, Representative Postum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one further question on the cars. Have you ever looked at whether or not it would be in the state's best interest to reimburse people to have their own cars for mileage and those kinds of things versus actually providing a car? And if you have any detail on the analysis that you went through in making that determination, that would be helpful.
You know, Superintendent, I think we should probably, having you start 3 minutes in a journey doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So I'm going to ask the if I can have a motion to approve the minutes of February 17th.
So moved.
Representative Haas makes that motion. Are there any corrections or questions about those minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner, Superintendent, thank you very much for your presentation. We're almost there. We'll have you come back when, Ms. McMahon? Not next week, but sometime after that, and we'll inform you about that time. There's no other business before the committee. We're adjourned.
You do.